You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Hi, everybody. This is Tom Shade, and this is the CLF's View TV show. You know what we do around here, and we're going to do it again today. Our special guest is Peter Morales, who is the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association. Woo! So, Peter Morales, president of the Unitarian Universalist. Boring, right? He's achieved the very pinnacle of, I won't even say that. That's terrible. How are you? What did you do this week? Just tell us that to get us started here. What was on your plate this week?
Well, I was in Colorado the first part of the week. I flew back yesterday. So it was a lot of the non-public part, the phone calls, a bunch of video conference. You know, so much of all our lives here, I'm finding folks at headquarters is a lot of it is spent looking at a computer screen, but in meetings that are video conferences. So just a bunch of little stuff this week. After a ton of traveling down to the conference at and Meg was there at the beginning of the entrepreneurial ministry, the third of the four big intensives around that.
Those are great.
In North Carolina. Then I came back and I've had meetings in New York and in Philadelphia, the fundraising part of the lot of travel. I'm getting paranoid though. This little snow cloud is following me around everywhere I go on the continent.
Bring it to Austin.
All right.
Hey, you're not in Minnesota, but it snowed without you. How could that happen?
Because it always snows in Minnesota. Doesn't require anything.
No, it's been. That's why we're so excited. It's been a really warm. I mean, we've had, you know, a little snow on the ground, but this is the real first. This is the first snow day all year.
Really?
And actually, it wasn't a snow day because it didn't start till late enough in the day, so school wasn't canceled. But I don't think school's been canceled a single day this year, which is sad for the kids. You know.
I know.
Actually, mostly because it's so cold, they might die at the bus stop. So we haven't had any of that either. And so I'm not complaining.
Right. Well, Peter, Joanna and her crew have put forward nominees for your job. And it's still, 17 months away, which puts us right up there with the U.S. president for long, extended campaigns, you know. But it kind of marks the beginning of the end for you, doesn't it? You know, I mean, it's kind of like now, you know, what, the lame duck thing? Probably not that for sure, but it is kind of coming round to the end. And so one of the questions I wanted to ask you about was to ask you to look back at your campaign for president, which was and just, you know, looking back, what was that like? What was that like? Because probably it was the last one like that. So how did that feel at that time? Was it, you know, I mean, I'll have to say this. What I was surprised at, I've always been surprised, is how incredibly emotional rank and file UUs get about the presidential election of the Unitarian Universalist Association, how much people read into it, you know, kind of, you know, not quite the cosmic battle of good and evil, but pretty darn close sometimes, it seems like. And I was wondering, I mean, having known you since then and having known Laurel before, I didn't think that was how you saw it. But so how did that feel at that time, seeing everybody else's kind of emotion around it?
Okay, there's several pieces to that. One is that, and this was actually a bit of a surprise to me, is that campaigning is a lot of fun.
Okay.
I mean, it really was. You're going all over, you're meeting people, and there's the old joke about, you know, you get to campaign in poetry and then you minister in prose because you're suddenly confronted by all the constraints. And
And, yeah, it must be exciting to kind of to get the grand sweep of the UU landscape.
Did it
change how you thought about the association when you saw so many different settings and people?
It didn't change it as much as it intensified it. I mean, it's amazing how many people are out there who care passionately about Unitarian Universalism and about its future. That's the good news. And back to one thing that Tom said, one of the things that was a little surprising, although it shouldn't have been, I was a journalist covering elections, you know, before being a minister, was just that not only the intensity, but the bizarreness of some of the speculation and attacks that would happen. I mean, happily, on a personal level, Laurel and I, we were not enemies. We were two candidates. We got along. We occasionally traveled together to certain venues. But boy, our supporters didn't always behave so well on both sides. And some of it got really weird. I mean, one memory that always struck out is there was something on social media wondering why I had concealed what my father had done, which I thought was kind of interesting because my father was a computer programmer for the federal government. I mean, it was who was a civil servant and then retired. I just never thought that what Dad did for a living was my campaign issue. So I never,
something you never heard about.
It never occurred to me.
Wow,
and
that would have changed everything on my part, you know. You know, when you ran, you know, I'll say you presented yourself as someone who understood marketing and communication and kind of data-driven strategy and those kinds of things. And that seemed to resonate with a lot of people as to what we needed at that time, the concerns about growth and the concern that we were you know, hiding our light under a bushel basket inadvertently. Did that skill set turn out to be as crucial in your presidency as it seemed at the beginning, or is there other skills that you thought you needed more when you got into the job?
That's interesting. The job is this, as so many CEO jobs are, there's the very public side, the public witness side, even some of the international part of it, for example, the being the spokesperson. And then there is the overseeing the operation of a $25 million a year national nonprofit organization. One of the things that was a surprise coming into the job, and it's not like I didn't know this because I'd been on the senior staff for a couple of years, but it's sort of like you can know that the Grand Canyon is a big hole and you can have seen 100 pictures of it. But there's something about standing on that rim and looking at it or walking down into it. It's just a very different experience, even though you're sort of intellectually prepared for it. Part of it is the number of pieces and the number of demands coming at you all the time. That was a bit of a kind of a shock. And the number of agendas, appropriately, that people have on the senior staff who all want to do this, that, or the other, you know. And of course, like anyone who heads a congregation, you know, you never have the resources to do what it is that you'd like to do. Any job I found in my life, any position, that when you're in an organization and you see the person on the org chart above you or two levels above you, what you see is power. When you get there, what you experience are constraints. Always. I can't do this, I can't initiate that, there isn't budget to do this. But that's life in you know. I mean, any parish minister here has lived through that. So.
Yeah, yeah. Even the ones who are just temporarily their lead minister.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
Not me. I control the world. I can get everybody to do whatever the heck I want. So.
What's that joke about the guy?
We should all be taking more advice from Asia.
What's that pledge sermon where the guy goes, the minister goes, the good news is that we have all the money we need. The bad news, it's still in your wallets. But, you know, another, my wife who works at a high level in hospitals, she said at a certain level, all jobs just come down to budgets and deadlines. <You know? laughs> At a certain level, it's all, you know, anything, it's all interchangeable in a certain way. The content isn't really that important anymore.
Tom Shade, come on.
Yeah,
Peter, yeah. Talk about the content. Some dismal picture of the world. Take us down.
We usually descend into cynicism later in the show. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was a hopeful sign.
You're about 20 minutes early.
No, and actually, one of the joys of being president, and really what attracted me to the position is the ability to frame the discussion, just to set the agenda, to raise issues in the movement. For example, the whole discussion around our needing to reach out in different ways, the whole congregations and beyond discussion, I think, has been an important one for the association.
I think that's been one of the you know, the most important contributions your presidency has made is to open that question up and to kind of go beyond, well, our sole purpose is to serve the congregations, but to ask the question, well, who's, you know, who are those beyond our congregations and what kind of organizations are they in and also as individuals, you know.
Well, it's really fascinating that, I mean, if we think of ourselves as an association, you start asking certain kind of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Be about servicing the members of the association. If you think of yourself as a religious movement, you start asking very different questions.
Mm-hmm.
You start asking, you know, how can we reach more people? Who are the people who are related to us but who are not members of congregations, which is, of course, many times. People. Who are the people that we're in serving in our communities and in partnership with in our communities? It really does set the right question and sets the mind focusing on different kinds of things. So I think that has been an important thing. And that's really one of the very rewarding things. That and then things like the entrepreneurial ministry program that we've done in close partnership with the UUMA, the Ministers Association. Again, it's not that one for me is not about a couple of dozen people who are involved in the program. It's really about the first step toward pushing for real culture change around expectations in ministry, that people not only have ideas and innovative ideas in a changing world, which our people do, but they're actually expected to have the skills to implement those ideas, which is something that we as ministers are not particularly well well trained for, ordinarily.
That hasn't been part of our...
Yeah, as a participant in that, I will say it is a game changer, having these business people come in. I mean, just last time, we learned this thing that just stopped me cold that I've talked to everybody that I've talked to about. You know, I've always just thought evangelicals were more generous than UUs, and that's why they can do so much stuff. But many of them have for-profit businesses associated with the church. And I'd never even thought of for-profit business. You know, I mean, I thought of, like, products that maybe somebody would give me a little money for. But that is just a whole different way to think. And, yeah, it is. I think it's going to ripple out, I think, from the people who are taking it and come home and say, guess what we learned? And then we're all committed to be mentoring other people as best we can. But yeah, I think it's that partnership with not only business, but some of the people, the religious people who are doing it better, is game changer. So yeah, I really appreciate the vision and the forward looking that went into holding that. I also think the move is a huge thing that you accomplished. I'm not really sure anyone else could have done it. I think it really will be part of your legacy, and I think even the most.
You say no one else would have been crazy enough to try it.
I think people feel very positive. Even the people who were super negative, I think, are pretty positive about it now. Is that your experience, or do you still get grumbling?
Oh, very little. In fact, one of the interesting things here was the UUA staff was not enamored of the idea. A lot of there was a whole spectrum from people who were mentally packed a year before we moved. Let me out of here. I want to go to the new place. To the folks who didn't want to, but it's been fascinating. This isn't just my impression, because like the architects came back a year later and did a survey of the staff for their own use. In terms of what's working well, what do people like in terms of designing spaces like this. And what they found, they shared with us, was a very high level of satisfaction. Because just the amount of interaction, so much of organizations, especially in this era, succeed to the extent that they use the talents and the energies of their people. Yeah. And that really happens best when people have the opportunity to bounce things off of one another. And our previous offices were designed really for a 19th century organization of real specialization and stability. And people, folks who never worked there don't appreciate how, I often say that if, let's say, Tom, you and I both worked at 41 Mount Vernon in program area. If we didn't walk in at the same time, we would never know that each other was in the building.
Wow.
Yeah. You just didn't see people, and there was no lunchroom. And then there was a separation between 41 and 25.
Maybe if there had been groovy coffee machines, people would have met each other there the way they do now. I mean, some of the upgrades in the feeling of being here were pretty significant. You used to have to bring in your own Mr. Coffee from home if you wanted a beverage at work.
But you hear people saying, you know, I ran into, had a conversation with so-and-so. We've worked here for 7 years. I never met them.
Wow. You know, it's interesting because, you know, one line of thought out there now is that physical places don't mean anything anymore, that everybody meets virtually and that, you know, you could run an organization without an office. And then there's this experience which says the quality of the physical space is actually crucial to whether or not an organization runs well or uses its talents well. So it's kind of like there's two contradictory opinions out there that I have held both at different times, right?
Between well, I think it's both. What we found, and this came up, we had a big meeting of field staff, and some of our field staff had not been to the new headquarters because we hadn't. And they so appreciated time together, a couple of days. And what I find is that then if you and I have been involved in face-to-face and extended interaction, then the video conferences are richer. You need you need both. But if you just have the video kind of experience without also the in-person experience, then it becomes kind of too abstract.
Are you calling the view abstract? Because this is all we do. This is all we do is video.
Well, I was going to say, as an employee of the Church of the Larger Fellowship, it is possible to do to do virtual employment well and with deep intimacy and communication, but it takes intention.
Yeah.
And a lot of practice. Really fun to see, and we get really excited when we get to see each other in the flesh.
Yeah. I got another question.
But there's a flip side to it. I often joke that this gives new meaning to you'll never walk alone.
Well, nobody is ever bored or lonely anymore, you know. I was at the DMV recently, and there was like 100 people waiting for a really long time. One of those things where the number is on like 82, and you're number, you know, 54, and you're going like, how's this? But there was no sign of anybody being upset or impatient, because everybody was like a face in their phone, you know, it was quite calm and tranquil, where usually those things are like on the verge of like rebellion and riot, you know, like people are going to rush the counter there, you know. So the phones are, you know, you're never bored anymore. I had another question about expectations and how things worked out. You're the first president and, you know, staff leader as we switched over into policy governance, right? And all of the, you know, if you just step back and you go, okay, so of course there was like a period of like adjustment and elbows and struggling and so on like that went down. And just, you know, you have to say in a certain way that's kind of probably just an inevitable part of the process, independent of people's personalities.
I don't think it's inevitable, but...
there was. maybe not inevitable, but an understandable part of the process that goes on. So do you think that if you were talking to Allison and Sue Phillips, Allison Miller and Sue Phillips, how does the... how does the vision casting, vision creating part of the job, how has that changed since you've come into this new era where you're dealing with a different kind of board and a different kind of relationship? Is it still, I mean, everybody who approaches the campaign, you know, approaches the presidency thinks that's like the number one thing you do is that you cast this vision and then it happens. Right, somehow. Is that really as crucial a part of job, or is that as people have thought? Or how's that changed?
There are a lot of pieces to that. So let me.
Yeah, I back out.
I think the greatest value of the presidential campaign and having it be, I'm not sure it needs to be 18 months, but of having a period of time. It's really the one time in our associational life that people can talk about, and there's an extended discussion about alternate paths into the future, mm-hmm. Unitarian Universalism. And so the discussion and the debate around that, I think, has a huge value. Elections for members of the board, elections even for moderator, don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you think about the institutions that are the most successful institutions, I mean, think of MIT, think of Harvard, think of University of California. Can anybody ever name who the members of the board are? No, I mean, because the boards can provide oversight. It's a critical role. I've served on tons of boards. But boards have a very, really difficult time leading. It's just not in the nature of things. One of the things that we haven't worked out, I think, as a movement, is that tension between adopting a form of governance that is designed for nonprofit organizations, mm-hmm. who select their CEO, mm-hmm. as opposed to an organization where the president, the CEO, is elected by members. So it creates an inherent, not an impossible, but inherent tension around who is setting direction.
Yeah, I have to say, Peter, as a relative newcomer to UUA governance, like, it strikes me as a constitutional crisis, even, that we govern in this way. Am I overreacting, or
Oh, so this is the Super Bowls this week, so I'll use a football.
All right.
Love a Super Bowl. We don't get a lot of Super Bowl references on The View, gotta say. So this is a real departure for us.
I've mentioned it a number of times. At some level, I mean, you can look at, say, congregations and organizations that use policy governance that are fabulous organizations, some that are in the middle, and some that are dysfunctional. The form of governance that you take is really not that much a predictor. What I've said is, you know, you can run the West Coast offense and win the Super Bowl, and you can run the West Coast offense if you're a professional football team and finish last place in your division. Both have been done. It's really around execution, I believe, and the ability to form a partnership. So right now, I mean, we're in a period of, I think, a really rich partnership with the board and the administration, where people have an understanding and respect for different roles. The board is anything but a pushover, takes its fiduciary and risk assessment kinds of roles very seriously. And so it can work, or it can be very cumbersome, which I thought it was earlier in my administration, where I think, in my opinion, that the board was overly kind of rigid and literalistic in its implementation of a style of governance, and then went, you know, we had 349 policies that were supposed to be monitored. Oh, really? And the amount of effort, the real opportunity cost that was lost, I mean, the amount of effort it took to do the work of monitoring, which had very little, frankly, very little value, was one of the things that I wish had been done differently.
Does that end up translating into sort of a compliance mentality, too, when you have such a big monitoring burden? Or, I mean, does that hamper creativity?
I'm someone who believes in monitoring and believes in transparency and believes in metrics. I mean, I've talked about that. The important thing is to select the right ones. And this board, I think, with the people who have more experience in that kind of governance, has cut way back on the number of things they want monitored and really focusing on, in my view, the most important things. And so then that works. It works fine. I mean, we're anxious to be here, to be transparent, even to the point of saying, hey, we tried this, it didn't work. I mean, I think you have to have that kind of honesty in an organization. It certainly didn't work at the level that we'd hoped. I mean, there have been a couple of things that I've initiated that are clearly that way. I would bring up initiative we had early that tried to involve congregations in conversations. It was a gathered here thing. Mm. In retrospect, we made it overambitious, and by doing something that was overambitious, we got less participation. We got a lot of really good stuff, but it could have been. I think Meg, if we'd done a kind of design thinking thing and prototyped it.
I think it was the name. We've just had too many things with names that sound just like that. And people like think they already did it, you know.
They already did it.
Yeah. Hey, but before we move on, just one question. I know that you're a Colorado guy. So are you? But you're also like the president of this entire, you know, national organization. Are you? Will you come out like supporting the Broncos, or like, you know, or do you just look at Carolina and know that there's going to be problems against whoever is up against Carolina?
Are you talking sports ball again?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
So who's going to get more runs? Is that what you're asking?
So I think, yeah, I'd like to see the Broncos win. I don't think they're going to. So.
Okay. Well, I have a more church-related.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. Becker.
So, Peter, I think one of those sound bites that I think will probably go into any sort of report about you in the history books will be your one about how we need to learn how to repel fewer visitors. Meg and I share a congregant. She is a member of Live Oak and the CLF, Pamela Lindzen, and she had a question about how can we attract and keep new UUs. Any thoughts on that?
Oh boy, you know, and I've done presentations and workshops on this, and so several things. Of course, what happens in an individual congregation, the UA has very little control. You know, I don't.
You can't fix us.
I can't make the minister and the volunteers friendlier. I can't edit a rambling sermon. I can't select the right volunteers for the religious education program. We can't here at the association. We provide a ton of resources and coaching and help, but it's a bank shot. You know, I mean, what would make our membership grow, there are a couple of pieces, is really determined by the culture of individual congregations. I do believe that when people go and for the first time or second time to a UU congregation these days, it's a very different thing than it was a generation ago. Because of the internet, they know who we are and what we stand for. So
they're pre-approved, is what I've heard.
I've called them pre-qualified. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't be there. I mean.
Right.
They don't come with a Bible in hand looking for Bible study. Mm-hmm. They know who we are, what we stand for. So to encounter someone at the level of opinion and tell them what we think about things and our positions is, I think, to miss the boat entirely. What if I'm going, and I can still remember going for the first time, the real question is, are these my people?
Mm.
And that's a relational and an emotional and an affective thing. And we could do a lot more to encounter people, I think, at that level. The real question is, do I belong here? Does my partner belong here? Will my kids feel like they belong here? And then there's another huge challenge today in that church, attending church used to be seen as normative and a good thing in American life. That's increasingly less the case. So when I was a parish minister and serving a congregation that grew a lot, even now in that situation, I think our congregations, this is the whole congregations beyond stuff, we need to know how to learn how to engage people in other venues than simply the folks who are going to come to us on Sunday morning. Because going to church has become a countercultural kind of thing for young adults, and church is a bad brand. Church is associated with stuffiness, narrow-mindedness, hierarchy, sexual abuse,
hypocrisy.
All those kinds of things. It doesn't have that kind of positive value it has. And one of the tragedies is we have so many people who really are our soulmates, who care about the same things that we care about, who want depth, who want religious, spiritual community, who want to make the world a better place and participate with others to do that, and they don't think of going to church or a UU church as a means for doing that.
Yeah.
So you've got to find those people.
Yeah, our competition isn't the church down the road. It's Starbucks and the New York Times. Do you feel that, I think that the critical question right now is not why Unitarian Universalism, but why church, period. Do you think that we as a movement are answering that question?
And that's a glass half full, you know, if you look at what's happened in you know, over a longer period of time, in 50 years, United Church of Christ has lost half its membership. The Methodists have lost half. We're within 4% of where we were 50 years ago. So every other kind of mainline or progressive religious movement would die for our numbers. And I'm not happy with them. Because
they're also five times. UCC is five times bigger than us, right? Is it some five times?
Yeah. But they lost a quarter of their members in 8 years.
Yeah. That's a scary number for sure.
Yeah.
Do you think do we need to decenter Sunday morning worship?
So one of the things that I'm really excited about in the last 17 months, and it's in its kind of embryonic phase now, is multi-faith outreach. I mean, I think the future looks much more multi-faith. The kind of distinctions that were important a couple of generations ago are not. And while we have a long history of doing some showing up together at things, whether it's environmental justice, the big thing in New York, or an immigration or racial Black Lives Matter kind of thing with these folks, what we've never done is actually together try to reach out to all those people. We're looking to do a symposium about that, a real kind of design thinking thing, bringing in and starting a multi-faith incubator. The chance of it succeeding are 1 in 10, which is really good. And no, because if it succeeds, it's the iPhone.
Right.
I mean, to the extent, and that's the kind of thing I think we have to do. We have to nurture that kind of innovation, learn from it, and adapt. And so the future is what we do. There's a real future for congregations, I believe. There's not a future for mediocre congregations.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Peter, this is Hank. In your time that you've left as president, are there any initiatives that you really want to make sure to get done the last time? I mean, what you were talking about sounds quite interesting, and I think is a whole new direction. So I'm going to ask that, and then I'll start there. Yeah. So what do you want to get done in your last 18 months?
There are a bunch of things that are ongoing. There have been initiatives that really aren't done yet. One, I mean, this entrepreneurial ministry that we've talked about is important, but this is just phase one. What needs to be done now is to design and really think about how do we spread that to where it becomes a normal part of the training and the culture in our ministry. The whole process of incorporating and aligning field staff with other national staff. It's been called regionalization. I hate that name because it's not about regions. It's really about having one Unitarian Universalist Association as opposed to continuing with an organizational form that was slapped together as an awkward compromise when the Unitarians and the Universalists came together and then just sort of continued existing with, 20 district Board of Trustees that are separate 501c3s that co-employ, who send us money so that we can pay people. I mean, it's a goofy kind of system. And there's a lot of work that still needs to be done on that, and that's a huge undertaking in our congregational life staff. There's the whole settlement thing, redesign for religious professionals, not just ministers that's going on. And that, Sarah Lammert's staff group, if I suggest one more project over there, it may be dangerous for my health because they've got so many things going that they're really they're running at full capacity. So yeah, there are a lot of things that are going on that need to be kind of finished. And that multi-faith part is the one that's sort of new and needs to get needs to grow roots. It's a very fledgling kind of thing now. It needs to get institutionalized. But I'm really obviously excited about that.
I understand that last week a group of people got together and talked about stepping forward more around racial justice. What do you do there before you go?
And this is very preliminary. I mean, the real, so looking further out, we're looking at doing, well, at Columbus, it'll really be a multi-faith gathering of some stuff. And then, Aisha was there. She can add to this. This is really looking at our grounding for this issue around racial justice, which is, alas, going to be not only the next president, but the president after that, and the president after that. It's a long culture shift in America. But the big thing that's coming up is General Assembly in New Orleans, which will be a real opportunity to build on the lessons we learned, I think, in Phoenix, at that Justice GA. This will be different, but it has the possibility of, again, connecting deeply the spiritual lives of UUs with their action in the world, to where there isn't, one of the things we struggle with is at times is having spirituality separated from our work in the world, and it's that connection that's vital, because without it, activists become embittered because it takes so long. And without the action in the world, the spirituality becomes, I think, narcissistic over time.
Yeah, well said, Peter. And the part that I think Bob touched on a little earlier that also came out in the meeting was how much of our resources as an association are focused on Sunday morning, where a lot of our social justice work, which we actually mapped out on paper, is not dependent on Sunday morning. And one of the people of color in the room said, well, I tolerate worship so I could do social justice. And how heartbreaking is that? Well, what, you know, to Peter's point, let's have theological grounding, because we do have it for what we do, so that we're spiritually fed when we are working towards a better world and beloved community and racial justice. So I, you know, it was a one-day meeting. I flew out from Seattle, and I will tell you, I left really inspired, and I was skeptical at how much can we really, you know, how Unitarians like to navel gaze, but I will say I was really, really inspired when I left. So it was an excellent meeting, Peter. I'm glad that it happened, and I think there are seeds that have been planted on focusing our thinking moving forward. So,
Aisha, you were there because of Lareda, correct?
No. Actually, I was not representing Lareda. Because Tequina made clear what Tequina, Boston, and I, and Peter, and the folks in the room have been in conversation about how to strengthen and make connections for our racial justice work within our congregations, which are mostly white, and so. When you're a leader of color in this denomination, and 98%, I don't know what the number is, but very high percentage is white, how do you navigate that? So it was actually mostly UUA staff of color, and then it was me, Cheryl Walker, and Christina Rivera, I believe, Peter, who weren't UUA staff other than the facilitators. But otherwise it was, it was mostly UUA staff.
Yeah, and for example, Cheryl has a kind of dual role. She's the incoming president of the Ministers Association, but she's also, you know, African American woman who is a parish minister who lives this all the time.
Next to last question, and we're saving the last question. Next to last question is: what advice would you give Allison Miller and Sue Phillips?
Oh boy.
Run.
No, it's, you know, being president, despite the fact that I can grouse about this, that, and the other kind of time, I mean, it's a fabulous privilege and opportunity in life. I guess one thing would be that it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. And part of what I've struggled with at times was, I've used the metaphor of when I was a parish minister, I felt like I was driving a sports car. And because people could have ideas, you could have an idea, you know, people on the board who might need to approve it, you're meeting with them, you're talking to them all the time. You can go from the idea to implementation in 2 or 3 months. And that's just not the case in a national association like ours. And so you have to kind of back off and take a longer view. And just for me personally, I'm not a patient person.
Mm.
Which is sometimes a good thing, because impatience gets you to prod and try to move things. But also you've got to get perspective, you know, on and take the longer view is really important.
So a longer view?
Okay. Yeah. Harlan Limper, around, there's a sort of ongoing inside joke here at the headquarters. Every time there's some impossibly huge project, Harlan is a chief operating officer, for folks who don't know, and he'll go, oh my, he says, this could take weeks. And so the ongoing joke here is for everything that's impossibly huge is, oh dear, this could take weeks. Well, the truth is it takes months and years.
The impossible we'll do today. Right. Or is it the improbable we can't do, the impossible takes a little longer. Go ahead.
Sorry, shall I ask the last question here?
Well, we got like 5 minutes left.
Well, let me ask. So last week, Keith Cron was on, and he was talking about the shortage of parish ministers. And so we were wondering if, one, you could maybe mention that, talk about that, and two, if the second part of this question is, after your time as president is over, will you be going back into search? You know, it would make Keith very happy to have another minister who can go back into the parish.
So the...
Do you have your package together?
No, nobody has a packet anymore. I understand it's all a website.
That's true. Is your website created yet?
Part of the sort of, I should live so long, you know, is in 17 months I'll be almost 71 years old.
Oh my goodness.
So I've never had a sabbatical, so I'm going to do nothing for a while and catch my breath and look around and recharge and then see what's there. With the ministers, it gets, like so many things, it gets complicated. It isn't just the numbers, it's where people are willing to live or able to live because of partners. And so often there are enough ministers, but there aren't enough ministers willing or able to go to all the places where we have openings. It's a real challenge. One we've seen coming, I mean, I talked about it in the way back in the campaign, that, you know, half of our ministers are 58 and older.
Mm.
And, you know, it's not higher mathematics to figure that out. The last General Assembly, it was a record number of people retiring in the service of the living tradition. It was stunning. And part of it, it's a big bump because so many people, because of the huge recession, delayed retirement. So we're seeing what's happening in so many institutions with the kind of baby boom bulge, is the boomers are getting to that age. There's a flip side of this. If you're a younger parish minister and there are going to be fabulous opportunities coming up. I mean, many of our large mid-sized and larger congregations. I still attend the senior ministers of large UU congregation annual meeting, known as SMULUC, what a wonderful acronym. And just in the last 2-3 years, the turnover there is just shocking. It used to be kind of a stable group with a few people coming in and out every year. So it's a challenge. And there are tremendous opportunities in ministry because of it, too.
Excellent, excellent.
Yep. Well,
I don't know. Maybe I'll become a blogger like Tom.
All you have to do is figure out how to make money doing it, and you can, and the world is your oyster. I have yet to crack that problem. You can get a lot of readers, and nobody gives you a nickel.
As we come to an end, I want to apologize to the people listening on the podcast that this live view was, we don't know what's going on with Google Hangouts, but something is. So you're listening to this, you're watching this later. We wish you could have been with us live. Peter loves to answer your questions anyway, so email him. Again, we spent a lot of time trying to figure this puppy out, but I don't know. YouTube has started live streaming. I'm wondering if somehow we're getting tangled with Google on the air. Anyway, I apologize, and I'm glad you listened, and I hope you learned a lot. Thank you so much, Peter, for coming.
Well, thank you for having me. This is
Thank you.
Yep. Super fun.
Yeah.
Have a good day, everyone.
Who's coming next week? We got Black Lives of UUism, and I hope it's live.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.